Solomon, in this, is wrestling with this. We cannot see it without the Puritan eyes of Americans. I mean, we blush, but other cultures wouldn't blush. We have issues with the intimacy, but other cultures wouldn't have.
Right,
because
right.
We are so ingrained in this Puritan culture of this is dirty. This is, you know, which, because it was just interesting. I was third Friday speaking at a conference and talking with a gentleman who is, I forget what country of origin, but I want it near Greece somewhere. And it was just interesting for him, even talking about mental health, there was an intimacy, the way that he talked about interacting with people, that made me blush. But he was like, and I asked him a little bit about it, because he was talking about the questions he would ask. And I was like, his idea of intimacy and my idea of intimacy are so different, because I'm so embedded in this white Puritan culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so we come to it, and I'm just like, it was never intended to have that lens. It is a beautiful thing that we need to be okay with and comfortable with and not blushing. And we can say to each other these things, you know. And
yeah.
Fast forward to then yesterday, I was watching, and I encourage everybody to, Will Ferrell and Harper, one of his closest and dearest friends. They did a documentary. And it is one of his closest and dearest friends that transitioned during COVID.
Okay.
And they went on a road trip. Will Ferrell said, let's go on a road trip. And so they went on a road trip across the country for a lot of reasons. But two, to discover what does intimacy look like for them now.
Mm.
And it was one of the most beautiful documentaries I've ever seen. And there was intimacy. They were saying words that said to me, there were times that Will Ferrell sounded like Song of Songs in their relationship.
Hmm.
And it was this, how we need to be okay. There's nothing romantic about their relationship. They are two people who love each other deeply as friends, but got to a place where, can we just get rid of all of this Puritan whatever, and let's just speak to heart to heart. And all I kept thinking the entire documentary was, this is Song of Songs.
Hmm.
This is intimacy with another person, and not being afraid. To no. Where it ended with him, you know, giving his friend a gift of diamond earrings.
Right.
To say, you get to be beautiful whenever you want to be beautiful. And I'm like, that's intimacy. I mean, he was giving his friend a very intimate gift that normally a spouse would get, you know, I mean, these beautiful diamond earrings from Tiffany. That's not something that just two bros would do.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the point of, like, there's an intimacy now. Because we've allowed ourselves to share in a way. And it struck me, I'm like, that's letting go of white colonialism, Puritanism.
Mm.
And I think that's what I just keep coming back to. We can't read Song of Songs without that lens. And it makes me sad. Because I want to be able to read it without all of the crap that his society has put on us.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah. Two important things there. One, perhaps it is a call to us to learn to hear this language with some comfort, like to lean into it a little bit so that we can speak it. And again, we've mentioned this multiple times and we'll say it again, not for the last time, I'm sure, how different all of our reading of Scripture and our relationship with God would be if we began with Song of Songs, if it was the lens through which we saw every other word from God in Scripture. That would be a very different worldview. So it's an invitation to move past one particular lens that we've been using for so long. Secondly, it's also a helpful reminder on where we actually are at, and so we can understand one another's discomfort with some of this language, and we can be sympathetic to it. While it's still an invitation to move more deeply into it, we can also understand, I met with someone for lunch and they were saying the language just still, it's just so uncomfortable, I can't even hear it. I just can't even listen to it. You know, I keep showing up, but I don't even want to hear the words. You know, it was that hard. And it gives us some sympathy. Okay, I understand why. This is the water in which we've swum for a long time. And in fact, it's interesting, it seems it's especially difficult, it's difficult for males and females, but Lisa and I were walking the other day, and we saw these two girls who were just holding on to one another, holding one another's hands, skipping along, and Lisa said, man, in our culture, two men can never do that. I mean, Michael and I go to Jazzy Bagels. We don't hold hands. You know, we're not running in arm around arm. We don't do that. So it's even more difficult in our culture, not just that Puritan inheritance, but also just the various gendered inheritances we've received. So, yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, I'm gonna give that challenge to everybody here to go and try that. Tell me how it goes, please. Okay, thanks for those reflections. Let's read Song of Songs 5 together. And we'll do what we do before. We'll just listen, see what we hear. We'll talk a little bit about the letter. But then we'll remember Paul's words. Sometimes the letter kills on its own, and you need the Spirit to give it life. And so we'll ask, okay, what is the Spirit speaking to us through these words? So let's do two readings. One, just an initial, hear the language. So this is very, we're in the middle of the poem. Again, this is chapter 5 of 8, so right in the exact middle. 16 verses, like the last chapter was. It starts with the beloved, and in our version of that, that's a traditional male figure. The beloved is speaking, then the chorus speaks, and then starting in verse 2, the lover, the traditional female figure, the lover will start speaking. Okay, so here we go. Carrying on from where we ended with chapter 4, come to my garden, the lover says, and the beloved says, I do. I come to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gather my myrrh with my spice. I eat my honeycomb with my honey. I drink my wine with my milk. Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. I was sleeping, but my heart was awake. Listen, my beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew and my locks with the drops of the night. But I'd put off my garment. How could I put it on again? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? My beloved thrust his hand in the opening and my inmost being yearned for him. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh upon the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but did not find him. I called him, but he gave no answer. Making their rounds in the city, the sentinels found me. They beat me, they wounded me, they took away my mantle, those sentinels of the walls. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him this, I am faint with love. What is your beloved? More than another beloved, O fairest among women. What is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus charge us? My beloved is all radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. My head is the finest gold, or his head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside springs of water, bathed in milk, fitly set. His cheeks are like beds of spices, yielding fragrance. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. His arms are rounded gold, set with jewels. His body is an ivory panel, decorated with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns set upon bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His speech is most sweet, and he is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Okay. Okay, take a moment. From that chapter there, any impression that you received, just whisper it to the person next to you. We're not going to share these out loud, just an initial impression. What did you hear in chapter 5? Share something. Think of something. Share it with someone sitting next to you, and then we'll move on. Okay, and a reminder, please hear this both in its literal human intimacy way and its allegorical human God way. Hear them both the whole time. Okay, let's read it one more time and just reflect on what a few of the words mean and what the context is, all of that. We'll do the letter, and then we'll say out loud what we hear from the Spirit, okay? So, one more time. I come to my garden, my sister, my bride. Recall that the language of sister and bride is not meant to be literal. I mean, who knows if they're married or not, but it's not meant to be literal, my sister, my bride. In other words, they didn't marry their siblings. That's not what's being said here. This was just, that was the language of endearment. Those were the closest, most intimate relationships a human had. And so you refer to someone that way with affection. I come to my garden. The lover had just invited the beloved to come. And the lover says, and the beloved says, okay, I will come. I come to my garden. I gather my myrrh with my spice. I eat my honeycomb with my honey. I drink wine with my milk. It's interesting. All of that language, the myrrh, the honeycomb, the wine, the milk, the honey, none of that was the language the lover had just described was present in the garden. So why now is the beloved saying, yes, I'm going to eat the honeycomb and honey and wine and milk, when none of that was what the lover had just described was available in the garden? It's intriguing. And we can reflect on it later, just pointing it out. That it's there. The language shifts from the fruits that were in the garden, according to the lover, to the language that was the language God used for the promised land. So intriguing shift there. And then it says at the end, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. No one's quite sure who's meant to be talking right there. Who is saying, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love? Best guess, it's probably the chorus is coming in and saying, They're looking on this intimate relationship between the lover and the beloved and said, eat, friends, drink, be drunk with love. The language of friends is significant. Friendship implies equality, which would have been a different thing to say culturally and theologically about these two human beings. So pay attention to that because the word comes back at the end. Okay, and then it shifts. Now here the lover says, I was sleeping, but my heart was awake. Now, all of a sudden, the lover is not paying attention to the beloved. But the lover's heart is awake, but mostly not attending to the beloved in this moment. And then here's a voice. The heart is still attuned to it. The heart's still there, even though mostly not. Listen, my beloved is knocking. And then again, the beloved says, open to me. Can I enter? Right? In the very literal thing, he's standing outside a door, knocking on the door. My sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. Similar language that had been used of her before is used here. My head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. On a literal level, that's just saying, hey, it's cold outside. Can I come in and dry off here, right? And it's interesting what the lover says in response. The lover offers up what seem to us pretty weak excuses for not opening the door. I got my pajamas on. I mean, do you want me to get dressed again? I already washed my feet. What if they get dirty? I mean, strangely delayed, weak almost, excuses for not letting the beloved come in. What in the world is that about? So the beloved thrust his hand into the opening. The idea here is like just trying to get the lock, trying to get in himself, trying to open it, trying to find a way in. And that inspires my inmost being yearn for him. The lover is inspired by that effort towards her. Inspired now. Okay, I'm fully awake. Okay, let me stop having excuses. Fully inspired all of a sudden. And so, the beloved, I rose. I opened the door. My hands dripped with myrrh. Myrrh this whole time has been like gratuitous abundance of love, you know, that's appropriate for this level of intimacy. And now her hands are dripping with it. Her fingers with the liquid myrrh. She gets it all over the bowl as she opens up the door. I open to my beloved. And the beloved is gone. turned away. The lover delayed, paused in the lover's sleep, and it was too long. And now the beloved, it feels like, is absent. And so the lover says, "My soul failed me when he spoke." That soul, that word soul, could be my spirit failed me, my breath failed me, my consciousness failed me, my life force failed me. Maybe I should have just gotten up when he first called, but I didn't. I ignored. I wasn't fully awake. I was bothered. It was going to be a lot of effort, so I didn't. And now the beloved is gone. So, as we saw in chapter 2, the lover thinks it's a good idea in the middle of the night, half-dressed, to go running out into the middle of the street. I sought him, but did not find him. I called, but he gave no answer. Only this time, once again, the sentinels show up, making their rounds in the city. The sentinels, whoever that might be, found me. This time it doesn't go so well. They beat me. They wounded me. They took away my mantle, like, you know, maybe the robe or whatever was over, pajamas. Those sentinels of the walls all had been good. The love was great. Their world could not have been better. It was like the Garden of Eden, as the lover described it in chapter 4. And now all of a sudden there's this reminder. Even in the midst of all that joy, tragedy and suffering and pain, and in this case probably injustice, are still present, even in the midst of all of that goodness. But we have no indication of how the lover responded to that. She disregards it and moves on and says to, again, the chorus, the daughters of Jerusalem, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him this, I am faint with love." The same words that she used back in chapter 3, that word faint can mean, faint with love is literally lovesick. I am lovesick. I'm in pain. I'm in so much love. And I delayed. I waited. I didn't respond. And now I can't find him. And I'm sick. I am sick with this love. And then, yeah, lover is traditionally the woman character. Yeah. And beloved, although all the commentaries switch it back and forth. It's very confusing. So the chorus then says, "What is your beloved?" That's the male character. "What is your beloved more than another beloved?" It's hard to tell if they're genuinely asking, like, "Oh, tell us about this person." Or if they're like, "What's yours better than any other? Why should we care?" You know. But they do say, "O fairest among women." So perhaps they are good friends. "What is your beloved more than another beloved that you charge us in this way to help you find your beloved and then tell him you were faint with love? You are lovesick." And so the lover goes on an extended description, just as the beloved had done for the female character, now the lover does for the male character. This entire description is going to feel a lot like, have you ever seen a picture, or maybe in person if you're lucky enough, have you ever seen a picture of Michelangelo's David, that statue? It's almost like this. The next five verses are this lover, this female character, pointing to the statue of David and saying, "My beloved's like that. That's what I'm talking about here. You know, one in a million. This is what I'm talking about." And so here come these descriptions. My beloved is radiant. My beloved's skin glows, right? Distinguished among 10,000. We'd say like one in a million. Stands out in a crowd. You know, in the lover's eyes, this is who the beloved is. I have eyes for no one but this human being. Head is the finest gold. Finest gold is actually two different words for gold. So translators aren't sure how to translate it, so they just put finest gold. But it's really, his head is gold, and then another word for gold. It's gold, gold. And then she's going to use a third word for gold when she talks about his arm, hand, finger. It's all the same word in Hebrew. So his head is gold, gold. His locks are wavy. That word wavy is what's called a hapax legomenon, which means it only occurs once in Scripture. Nobody knows what it means. And so they just guess based on the root. It could mean wavy and luxuriant, which is how the NRSV translates it. It could also mean wild and unruly, which is wonderful. It reminds me of that song, Seven Bridges Road, where it says, I've loved you in a tame way, and I've loved you in a wild way. This could be like luxuriant or just wild and unruly. Who knows? Black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside springs of water. She's using some of the same language he used to describe her. There's a mutuality here to this intimacy that seems significant, as if they're suggesting, though we'll get to this when we talk about spirit, but as if they're suggesting it doesn't work if only one person is invested here. It needs to go both ways such that you outdo one another in showing affection. And so she uses all the same language he had used of her. His eyes are like doves beside springs of water, bathed in milk, fitly set. It's like bright white eyes, you know, whatever color they are, glowing in a cup of milk. His cheeks are like beds of spices. So we move from visual now to scent, which is significant in this entire poem. We've heard it over and over again. Scent often becomes a metaphor for other things, but his cheeks are like beds of spices, yielding fragrant. His lips are lilies. Now we're going maybe into taste when the kiss, you know, he had compared her to lilies. Now she's comparing his lips to lilies. So this mutuality here. His arms are rounded gold. There's gold for the third time, set with jewels. The word arms probably would be better translated hands. That have rounded gold rings on them, but it doesn't matter. The word means arms, fingers, hands, it doesn't matter. Rounded gold, set with jewels. His body is an ivory panel. Again, you're imagining a statue here. It's a statue made of all the like most precious materials in the world. All of this imagery is just to say, I'm taking the most precious metals and minerals I can imagine, and I'm saying that's how valuable this love is to me. That's how I choose to view this human being. Decorated with sapphires. Legs are alabaster columns set on bases of gold. And then again, the word occurs again. The lover really must admire the beauty of gold and says, if that's the best thing I know, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I think of you. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. Lebanon cedars were the premier, most fragrant, best absolute cedars in their known world. That's what my beloved is like to me. And then, so we have visual, and then we went to scent, and then we went to taste, and now we go to speech. Your word is most sweet. In other words, all this together, you're not just desirable physically. You're desirable in all these various ways. Even, you know, the speech, your word stands for intellect and emotions and the way you relate to other people. You're altogether desirable. The physical isn't enough. I need you to be desirable in all ways. That's what you are for me. And then, as if turning back to the chorus, the lover says, this is my beloved, O daughters of Jerusalem, and this is my friend. So it ends on the word it began with, that word friend, and it's significant. You remember in John 15 when Jesus says, I no longer call you servants, but now I call you friends? That word is significant in a way it doesn't matter for us in our culture, but in their culture, everyone had a social status that you lived under, right? And not many people were equals, but friend was the way to describe equality, which would not have been used of, say, a man and woman in a relationship. It wasn't friendship. It wasn't equality in that way. But now twice in this chapter, the poem has gone out of its way to say, this is my friend. This is my equal. Which again, culturally would have been surprising. Theologically, even more surprising. Because if this is allegorically, not only literally, but allegorically about our relationship to God, calling God my friend, again, that's just unheard of, because how can you put yourself equal with God in this way? And yet, this is what the poem is, for some reason, encouraging. This is my beloved, and I call this my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. And that's where chapter 5 ends. Okay, so there's some of the letter here. Let's talk about the spirit. That is, what does all of this inspire in us? What word do we hear today from this that we might take out of it? But if that's too daunting, what do you receive? What have you heard? What do you question? What do you wonder about? Sarah.
Verse 16, his speech. Other translations put his mouth.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Yeah. So the word, Sarah asked this. In verse 16, it says, his speech is most sweet. The word for speech there could be translated mouth. Mouth is not the most accurate translation, but it's not inaccurate either. And so they have to make a decision. It's like many of these words, right? Over and over again, we're sort of guessing on the translation. In this book, more than any other, I mean, every chapter, if you look at your notes at the bottom, it'll say Hebrew uncertain. I mean, we don't even know what the word means. Hebrew is uncertain. We don't even know what this means. The word for speech and mouth are very similar. It's probably most literally speech, but it could be mouth. And people think speech is weird because why do you go from visual to scent to speech? Wouldn't it make more sense to go back to the mouth and something? And others have said, no, it's trying to be the fullness of the person. So speech as well. Either could be right, though. Half translation do it that way, half translation the other way. Kevin?
I'm reminded of a Hallmark story.
Okay.
Where there's this tension of the two people are attracted, but they don't get together until the end of the show.
Right.
Musicals are
yes.
Plot. And then even
we've seen that plot theme before.
You know, don't forsake each other except for maybe a season.
Yes.
There's kind of heightened tension when you're not just all fluently hitting on all cylinders with your relationship.
Right. It's significant here that this poem that means to celebrate both human intimacy and human divine intimacy, right? It's significant that it says, even in the best of gardens, and you know, we cannot help but think of the Garden of Eden in chapter 4, right? Even there, the fact is there's sometimes difficulty and absence and a feeling of disconnection. That is part of the cycle of love in our world. It just is our reality. Let's not deny it. Let's be open. That's going to be true of other humans. Fact is, it's going to be true of God as well. And so then the question is, how do we respond to those moments where disconnection and absence are present, even when tragedy that this woman experiences is present? It's an interesting reminder there. Jen?
Yeah, I was, because it's the female character that's out seeking, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and so the fact that, like, the sentinels have been helpful in the previous verses.
Right.
And then when the female character goes out seeking, the sentinels beat her.
Right.
And so that, you know, that's what stood out to me.
Yes.
That, you know, when the man was out seeking, the sentinels were very helpful. And then when the woman goes out seeking, the sentinels beat her.
Yes.
And shame her by taking away her mantle.
Yeah, taking away the mantle, all of that. Yeah, all of it is troubling and abusive here.
Yeah.
And it was the woman both times, though. Let me clarify. Yeah, it was the woman both times out seeking. Now, the man, of course, does come. The man character does come and seek her. And then she goes and seeks him. So there is a mutuality there. The first time the woman character encounters the sentinels, and she's the only one who talks. And she just says, hey, have you seen this guy? They don't respond. She moves on. This time,
they basically
say nothing the first time.
So she's nothing.
Now the second time, or some commentators say, does she wait long enough to hear? The sentinels are often talked about as the prophets. That's how people allegorically often read them. So there's something like the prophets sometimes can give you guidance, but do we wait to listen to them? The prophets sometimes simply offer judgment, and it's wounding and painful. Whatever the case may be, the fact is this story of joy and delight and happiness has some tragedy in it, some abuse in it, some pain in it, and at least the reminder is this: not everything is good all the time. It's just not. In the midst of this beautiful love story, there is pain and suffering and tragedy, and the poem wants to acknowledge that. That feels absolutely unfair and uncalled for and problematic. And that is also part of our love story. It's fascinating.
Fascinating.
Okay. Someone else? Yeah, Melinda?
So reminiscent of the beginning. It starts off, and we kind of talked about this, I don't know, second week maybe, the lover doesn't feel beautiful. Mm. Doesn't feel, like there's this, there, you know, we talked about this, there's this, the fact that the beloved is so in awe
yeah.
of them was not what the lover was used to. And whether they weren't, they
for whatever, right, for whatever reason.
Yeah. Is the way that, in my mind, largely because that spoke to my soul, because that's largely how I was described uh-huh. most of my life. And so then it also makes sense, and so again, I can't help but think about, you know, my relationship, whatever it is.
Right.
That, you know, I think back to when Michael and I were in that early
yes,
stage.
Yes,
yes. And although I wanted to always be around him and he made me feel beautiful, there were times when I was ashamed of my beauty. Like,
yes.
I've already admit I'm not all put together. I'm not, so I am going to be hesitant because are you going to judge me for being not fully put together? Because that's what I'm used to. And so the hesitancy makes perfect sense to me.
Right.
I've already washed my face. I don't have my makeup on. My hair's not all done. I'm not in the most beautiful negligee. I just have whatever was laying there on the side that I just threw on, the t-shirt. I don't feel beautiful right now, and maybe you'll see me as everybody else sees me. And so there's that moment of, is what you see me real?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that hesitancy, and when he puts his hand in, it's like, oh, that's right. You don't care about any of that.
Yes.
But absolutely, all of the language and all the voices of what the lover has been told their whole life
right.
creates that hesitancy, which is so normal, mm-hmm. right? And then it's like, oh, crap, I listened to that voice again, and look what it did. It delayed me. And then the other part that I thought of, and again, maybe because I'm just related to my story, if we think of the sentinels as the religious prophets or priests, mm-hmm. whoever, those are the ones that often bring pain. I mean, mm-hmm. we did a whole thing on, you know, religious trauma.
Right.
And when I think about my story, the people who shamed me the most, the people who did the most damage to me, were believers, were teachers, were preachers, were that made me feel ashamed of truly wanting to seek and understand, and made me feel like a complete and utter, how dare you don't have such reverence? How dare you ask these questions in such a nonchalant way? And so to me, I'm like, yeah, that's mm-hmm. absolutely the way in which this, like, am I going to believe that, or am I believing the stories that I've been telling myself because everybody else has been telling me those stories?
Right, right. Yeah, such great reflections on that. And there is no book in the world in which religion comes off as poorly as in Scripture. I mean, over and over again, religion fails and is harmful and hurts. I mean, it is the story we've inherited, right? It is, and we constantly live up to it, right? Yeah, all of that. It's a fascinating thing that our sacred texts remind us again and again that our religion has failed constantly. That is quite a humbling thing that our sacred texts remind us of continually. And so you see it here. You can feel the you can feel that sense of sympathy to the lover who's saying, I don't know if you guys ever experienced this. Someone knocks on your door and you're with a friend or your spouse or whatever, and you're like, I'm not answering it. I haven't brushed my hair today. I'm in pajamas. Yeah, right? You're like, I'm going to hide and pretend I'm not here. Or could you go answer it for me? Because I don't even want him to see me, right? You can sympathize a little bit, taking that to a larger extreme about, am I worthy to stand in your presence? And we feel that. We ask that of ourselves. And this poem seems to suggest you are, and it's unfortunate you don't feel that. I want you to feel that, so that there's this beautiful moment where he thrusts his hand in, as it describes, to try and like say, I don't care. I want to be with you. You are as beautiful as I've just said in chapter 4, if only you'll believe it. And finally, she does begin to believe it, right? Do we finally begin to believe it? Although God says over and over and over again, you are beautiful. You are absolutely beautiful. And we think, no, but I don't do my best all the time. And God says, look, none of this matters to me. Can we hear that? And then can we offer that back in our, you know, horizontal relationships with one another? Nolan, and then we probably better close.
Yeah, just the, I didn't really hit on it until the last beloved. This is my beloved, behold, this is my beloved son, the actually the only time that term comes up later.
Yes.
Is in that relation too. So
yes. What a wonderful connection. And how wonderful that God says that to Jesus before Jesus has done a single thing. He hasn't accomplished anything. He hasn't healed anybody. He hasn't done anything. And God says, I'm already well pleased with you. You are my beloved already. And so that language is obviously a connection for us here, right? God's relationship to us. So, okay, that is a wonderful place to end. So we'll continue on with chapter 6 next week. And again, let me continually invite you to, again, lean into this just a little bit. So it becomes a lens through which now we hear, as Nolan was just pointing out, all the rest of these words we have in Scripture. And perhaps it opens us up to another way of seeing our connection with one another, and especially our connection with God. But we'll continue on with that next week. Okay, we'll end there. We'll see you all back in like 7 minutes or so. Thanks.